Lazar.
Jack Bonney.
With PiratePods.com, and we're on the phone with Steve Berlin from Los Lobos. Hey, Steve.
Howdy.
And we've got Carlos Covisa on the phone. He's our guest pirate today. Hey, Carlos.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Steve.
How are you doing, man?
On a long tour. You're beginning a long tour, is that right?
Actually, we just ended a long tour, to be exact. We've been functionally on tour since Halloween, since the end of October. So as I speak to you now, we are done with that. We're getting ready to do some recording. We're going to do a children's record in Los Angeles in a couple weeks.
Oh, good. A children's record.
So we're going to be, so we're going to be off the road for a while, thank God.
So what's it like, what's a typical meal for you guys on the road there?
A typical meal for us on the road? Oh, God, I guess probably by the law of averages, it would be a miserable breakfast at the Cracker Barrel, which are seemingly like a virus. They've infested the entire American Midwest, and for some reason, the guys in my band decided that that was a reasonable facsimile of breakfast, but I would go in silent protest and have tea and my own oatmeal and kind of curse them all. So we usually have fairly high standards on the road, but the minute we cross, so Nevada state line or something like that, it just goes all to hell and we end up eating the worst stuff in the world.
Yep. So Los Lobos, it's like a little 50s rock and roll, a little R&B, a little country twang, and of course Latin makes up Los Lobos for most people, but how would you describe your music?
No, that's not bad. It's got all that stuff, I guess. Making breakfast for my kids. That's noisy, I'm sure. I think it's a little bit of that and probably like a little bit of mid-60s British blues rock and probably, I don't know, a dose of Captain Beefheart here or there, little Charles Ives maybe. I don't know. It's just, it kind of really depends on what mood we're in and what we listened to last and what we're thinking about. But, you know, I think one of our strengths, I guess, has been our eclecticity. So we take a lot of pride in that and try to the extent that we can not to go over places and ground that we've already been through. So I don't know. I spend quite literally 0 minutes of my day thinking about what it is that we do, I mean, or what goes into it. You know, I mean, spend a lot of time thinking about how to do it, but not zero thinking about how it came to be that way.
Right. So, what keeps you together and strong as a band? Were you ever fearful of Los Lobos falling apart?
Not at this point. You know, I think like any other family, we go through ups and downs. But I think that everybody knows that what we do together is so much bigger than what we could do independently. And there is something unique about this combination of people playing these combinations of instruments. And, for better or for worse, it's, you know, we're very comfortable doing what we do. And, there's no real rules about it. I mean, we have a couple of the guys are going off to do a tour. And before we start this children's record, they're going to go do a songwriter's evening with type thing. And, you know, it's like, that's fine. It sounds like fun. I'd probably be there myself if they were playing near me. So we basically allow complete latitude and freedom for anybody to do anything they want to do. And then when it comes time to do Lobos work, then we just do the Lobos work.
Oh, that's nice. It's a nice balance.
So
yeah, well, it works for us.
Steve, are you all from East L.A.? Because you have, you're
I'm
you,
not.
You're not.
Yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia, and everybody else lives in L.A. I live in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, I know, you know, not to say your phone number, but we're originally from Seattle, and I recognized the area code. I was like, oh, Northwest, huh?
Yeah, I lived in Seattle for 16 years before I moved here, so I lived on Vashon Island. So
an island person.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm like Portland now.
You're in Portland now.
Right? Yeah, I like Portland better.
16 more days of sun or something like that.
You wouldn't know it today. It's as dark as dusk. The last 2 days, it's just been, you know what it's like around this time of year. It's just been so unbelievably dark all day.
Oh, yeah. And cold.
Yeah. Dark
and cold. But that's, you know, I like it. I have no problem with it. It's just bizarre. It seems like the sun never rose today.
Yeah. We remember that.
Yep.
Well, I first heard of Los Lobos, as did many of my peers, when, you know, of course, the movie La Bamba came out in 87, I believe it came out. But I think that's when we really fell in love with your band and the memory of Richie Valens. But Los Lobos has always been together as a band playing strong for many years, correct?
Yes, indeed.
So it was a strong band with... And you have all the original members, correct?
Yes, we do. Uh-huh. Yeah, I would be the new guy, and I joined in 83, I think, or 80-something, I don't know, 80-whatever. But yeah, everybody, all the original guys, pretty much doing the original stuff. So, we realized a long time ago that there was something, I'm not going to use the word magical, but there's something different about what happens when we all get together and play. So we just kind of roll with it.
Well, that's true. I mean, I've read a lot of the blogs about your band, and especially wrapped around that movie in particular, but a lot of fans were saying that, you know, I don't know if I like this movie because of, you know, the movie, or if it's Los Lobos that made this movie, because a lot of people, you know, think of your band when they think of that time. Guys are coming back really strong again, and with that album that you guys released last year, the Town and the City.
Town City, yes.
So, how would you describe that album as being different from stuff that you guys have worked on before?
Well, that one is it's our first literal concept record. I mean, Kiko was kind of a concept record, but you know, we weren't approaching it that way. It just sort of came. It turned into it when it was done, more or less. This one, about halfway through, we kind of realized we had a theme that, you know, it hadn't really dawned on us up to that point. But as we worked on it, and as the song sort of, you know, took shape and made themselves apparent to us, it became, you know, we were trying to figure out why all these songs had like the same sort of color and the same sort of key and same sort of groove and stuff like that, and no matter what we did to them, they just sort of all ended up going back to that place. So rather than fight it, we kind of sat down and realized that it was a theme that was emerging, and a concept about immigration and what it means to the children of the immigrants, as all of us in my band are. And when you live in California, it's a hot button issue for sure. You know, people are ranting and raving about it pretty much all day, every day. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure as this election season goes on, they're going to be ranting about it more. So we, you know, we just let it go and kind of followed the music where it wanted to take us, which was, you know, to this more or less, I would say, kind of a cinematic verite approach to the story of an immigrant. And it starts in a pastoral sort of peaceful place, but one that this guy needs to leave, and then it ends in the city, and ergo the name, you know, the town, the city, and sort of what happens in between, and what, you know, in no you know, we're not really proselytizing our point of view, but we're just sort of pointing, you know, just sort of talking about what the story is and what happens to this guy as he kind of travels through his various scenarios. So that's a long-winded answer to a short question, but it, to us, it was sort of like our first real attempt at writing something to a theme.
What makes you decide to sing a song in Spanish or English?
You know, some of them are in between. You know, it really sort of, it's the songwriter's choice. You know, sometimes it's one or the other or both. We've got two or three now that are, sort of go back and forth, which is really more the way people talk around us anyway. So it's not that big a deal. You know, it's just whatever sounds better. Like Caesar, I think, you know, his approach, you know, he starts in Spanish, and if the song merits it, he'll move to English, and probably the other, you know, just because this is, you know, he was the only one of us who was born in Mexico, and when Louis, for instance, writes a song, it's usually in English to start, or he'll have an idea on where he wants to go, and it'll become Spanish or something in between.
Right. So, Canción del Mariachi is the soundtrack from Desperado. How did, were you guys approached on that, or how did that all happen?
It was Robert Rodriguez, actually.
Okay.
He's a friend of ours, and it was, you know, he came to us well before the movie began, because he actually likes to shoot to music. He likes to have the soundtrack already done when he starts shooting. So wow. He came to us and not done, but at least, you know, he likes to have some thematic ideas to work from. So he came to us with the idea, and, you know, obviously it was the second installment of the mariachi story. And we just started fooling around, basically, just, you know, coming up with a few ideas. You know, he told us, you know, kind of where the scenes were going and what, you know, what was going to happen. I mean, he hadn't shot anything at that point, so he just had, like, a storyboard. And I just remember, at that point, hanging out with him a lot at his house in L.A. And, you know, he's always, I mean, now it's a legend, but back then, you know, no one really knew anything. You know, it was just the story about the $7,000 movie that won all the awards and all that stuff. And so he, it was funny because as the movie began, you know, he had like a relatively small budget. And then as we went, the budget was like quadrupling and tripling, and they kept pumping more and more money into it. And, you know, he was, you know, like all of us were just like, wow, I mean, what happened to our little, you know, shoot 'em up movie, man? It's just one mess. Because, you know, I guess Banderas was in another movie that was blown up, and Selma Hayek, I think it was her first movie, but people were becoming aware of both Robert and Antonio Banderas. And then as it affected us, which was kind of a pain in the ass, is like we would spend like weeks working on a sequence in the movie. And, you know, if there was something in the movie that we hadn't already cut a theme song to or some sort of sketch to, he was using what's called temp music, where he'd use like a Link Wray song the Link Wray song sticks out in my mind, right, just to make the story valid. So, you know, when he started the movie, he couldn't afford the rights to the Link Wray song. The Link Wray's estate was asking for, you know, $1 zillion. And as we were working on it and the movie studio started pumping more and more money into the movie, you know, I remember we spent like 2 weeks. There's that one sequence in the movie where he walks into the bar. It's like a 5-minute shoot 'em up, you know, where, you know, he keeps pulling guns, right, you know, one after the other out of his guitar case. And it's a very balletic scene. You know, it stops, you know, it's intense action that stops for a while and he reloads. He's looking around. And so we had cut this really intense, really very difficult 5-minute, you know, opera piece, basically, you know, sort of choreographed to the action and all this other stuff. So I called Robert and said, okay, man, we finally got the scene done. He goes, oh, I forgot to tell you, they gave me the money for the Link Race song. You don't have to do that one anymore. Just like, you've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding, man. We just spent 2 weeks solid working on this one scene. I'm like, okay, well, that's movie making. That's what happened. So, but, and we worked a little bit on Spy Kids as well. Same thing, you know, he likes to have the music in his head before he starts. So we actually spent some time in the studio with him. You know, he's also a really good musician. So we spent time with him actually in our studio in L.A., kind of jamming, you know, just playing ideas. And then we went into another recording studio, and we he had us play these sort of folk music themes, and then he went to, I think, Scotland or something, and had them all orchestrated with an 80-piece orchestra. And that's the, if you remember, that's the wedding sequence of Spy Kids, where, you know, they're getting married, and then the helicopters come and shoot the whole wedding party up.
Right.
And I guess since then, he's pretty much done everything himself. I mean, he really is that good of a musician. He doesn't really need to hire anybody anymore. He's a fine player, and, you know, if he comes up with an idea, he can execute it and, you know, do whatever he needs to do to get it across by himself. So right. I guess we're out of the job now with him.
Soy un hombre muy honrado que me gusta lo mejor. A mujeres no me falta ni el dinero ni el amor. Jineteando en mi caballo por la sierra yo me voy. Las estrellas y la luna ellas me dicen dónde voy. Ay, 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 ay. Me gusta tocar guitarra, me gusta cantar el son. Mariachi me acompaña cuando canto mi canción. Me gusta tomar mis copas, aguardiente es lo mejor. También el tequila blanco con su sal le da sabor.
You know, as we're moving into this technology, you know, technological advancements, things like MySpace, Instant Messenger, text messaging, do you feel like they're having a positive or a negative impact on music?
I think it's absolutely as positive as it can be. I mean, I think the people that are whining and crying about it really are just not paying attention. I think, you know, I've lived through lots of this stuff, you know, the very, very beginning when labels were actually places where people wanted to be and the people that worked for them were actually cool guys and used to go hang out with them to a situation where label people like hanging around with a, you know, parole officer or, you know, school teacher or something. And now it's, I think what this technological revolution has basically done is just, you know, given everybody the tools to create their own universe, really. I mean, to create through own marketing, create their own distribution, create their own fan base. And really, you know, what it's done, I think, is it becomes, you know, you really have to be, you can't just be just an artist now. You have to be an entrepreneurial artist, or at least have entrepreneurial friends, because, you know, this revolution isn't going to stop for any of us. You know, it's really, you know, it's going to go on. I think the major labels, by and large, are rendering themselves, you know, complete anachronism.
Right.
Almost useless to the process of making music. So I think what's happening now is, you know, what we're all being told is basically, you know, don't just learn to play guitar, but learn to web design and learn to network in a IM environment and, you know, develop all these other skills. And I think,
right,
for better or worse, I think that those skills are going to be serving the musicians of tomorrow just as much as, you know, being great songwriters or great singers or whatever. Now, that said, I think that you still have to be a great songwriter or a great singer. And, you know, I don't think, or I haven't heard that, you know, there's a lot of bad music made by people who are really good networkers. I think it's still, you know, the cream rises to the top and those who are good will stay good. And be good and succeed in this new environment. It's really just how you manipulate these tools and how you use them and really how smart you are.
Right.
And, you know, I read about these, what they call 360 deals now, where the labels, because they can't make any money selling the records, you know, they want to get into bed with the artists and sell merch and, you know, take money off of concert tickets and stuff like that. And I just say to anybody who's even considering that, I mean, you've got to have your head examined. That's the, you know, it's like, you know, you know, you don't bring your foot doctor to work on your car. And it's like, you know, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
these skills have absolutely nothing to do with one another. And they're in spheres where labels have historically known and done nothing. And I would say, you know, if you were just hiring anybody, if you had somebody that didn't know how to do one thing, why would you hire them to do four or five things?
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, we have a roadie who can't drive, you know, we don't tell him to drive the truck. You know, we just tell him to tune a guitar and stay away the hell away from the driving, you know, from the steering.
That's right.
Well, Carlos, do you have a question for Steve?
Yeah, hi, Steve. I'm curious, how did you come to join the band?
I came to join the band. I was in another band called The Blasters. This is late 70s, early 80s Los Angeles, when it was, you know, that beautiful moment when all things were possible, and there were bands on every corner playing great music, and I was in The Blasters, and we were our first, I think, headlining weekend at the Whiskey Go-Go in L.A., and this band that no one had ever heard of called Los Lobos opened and blew everybody away, and we came to learn that in this little cauldron that we had going on in L.A., where basically no band was more than, at that time, like a year or 2.5 years old, here these guys have been together for 7 or 8 years and, you know, had been playing this great music, and nobody had ever heard of them before, yet they were literally from, you know, not 10 miles across the river, but just there was a, almost like East and West Berlin, there was a, you know, a line that most people on the west side of the river never crossed. So we just kind of became friends, and they asked me if I wanted to learn some of their songs and play, because at that moment I didn't know anything about the saxophone tradition in Mexican music. And we just sort of, you know, started off by being friends, and I had, at that point, you know, I'd always wanted to produce, and I had produced a couple of things, and I started, before I joined the band, by producing, I co-produced the first two records, and it was another thing that they did for a zombie movie, a monster movie that I produced. And then probably during the course of making the first record, I started as producer, and by the end of the record, I was in the band.
Fantastic. And do you know how the Los Lobos name came about?
Yeah, they were asked to play. You know, everybody in the very, very early days, they're all in different bands. They were getting together to play Latin folk music. So they were invited to play, I believe it was a wedding. And the MC asked them what their name was, and they had never really thought about it because none of them were taking it seriously at that point. So there was a famous old band. I guess like the paradigm would be like, you know, like the Preservation Hall, you know, like an old a band from like 60 years ago. It was called Los Lobos del Norte, which is the Wolves of the North. So they thought, hey, it'll be funny, let's call ourselves the Wolves of the East. So they said, yeah, we're Los Lobos del Este. So that's where it started, and it just stuck. You know, they got gigs after that, and, you know, there it was, they're Los Lobos.
Well, Steve, thank you.
Thankfully, the old guys never sued him.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah.
Well, we'll let you get back to your breakfast.
All right, thank you very much. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much.